Jairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where we have decided to continue with Conversations with Sai, the book written by Dr. John Hislop based on his interactions with Bhagwan. As we have confessed time and again, the conversation ranges from different topics for different levels of spiritual aspirants, and frankly speaking, none of us are aware as to what level we are in. And depending on our level, we are able to interpret the conversation, we are able to understand the conversation, get inspired by parts of the conversation, or, you know, see, as we would say in the hostel lingo, see stars during daytime in some other parts of the conversation. But it is definitely an enriching experience to even go through this with a kind of academic rigor that we are going through currently. Because if not providing us insights and solutions and inspiration immediately, these discussions definitely act as seeds that remain buried within us, in our consciousness, in our hearts, and I'm sure that they will all sprout when the time is ripe, when the ground is fertile, and when there is the shower of grace that falls on it. So we continue with our efforts in going through these conversations. Generally, we would do one fortnight of conversations and one fortnight of a general topic. But seeing that we have not covered more than half of the book also so far, we thought we would focus a little bit more on the conversations. And also, the last week when we left it off, it was in the middle of a very intense and deep discussion. It would possibly get disconnected if we leave it. If we leave without going into it for quite a long time. And therefore, this fortnight as well, we are going into the conversations with Sai. And where we stopped last time, as I said, was at a discussion on Vedanta. But before we go into that, on behalf of everyone, I would like to offer humble pranams at the lotus feet of beloved Bhagwan and welcome Prem, Brother Prem, to the discussion. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all our listeners. Yes, the reason why we thought it's the right thing to do to continue this conversations is because what Swami is speaking is not completed. We were talking on a very important topic on mind. In fact, to give you a brief of what we covered last time, I think Hislop asked the question on the nature of the mind, what are the functions of the mind which are acceptable, and what does Swami mean by saying that, you know, you should not give too much, what is the role of the mind when compared to the Atma? Swami gives the example of the sun and the moon. Swami gives the example of the iron ball. The nature of the iron is not to be hot, and those, some of those very important Vedantic analogies that he had given. And the other thing, important discussion which came up was about decision making and about thoughts. How do you know the thought that you're having is a good thought? And a very beautiful explanation. Swami said, if you're in the ashram, you can come and ask Swami. But the next best thing, or an equally best thing to do, is sit in silence and ask within, and you will know. And Swami spoke about how when you know what is right and wrong, following the right gives you the confidence. And that is also a very, very important step, because we often stop at knowing what is right and wrong, but we never talk so much about following what is right. And which, from Swami's experience, it is, I mean, from Swami's explanation, it is clear that Swami is more keen on us following. We might get what is right and wrong. That discrimination, we might get it right maybe 1 in 10 times. But that one time when you get it, you do it. Swami says that that is more important than getting it right all the 10 times and probably not following it at all.
When we speak of this, it reminds me of what Swami would often state as bookish knowledge and practical knowledge. Even when we take something as mundane as playing a game, say a game of soccer or a game of cricket, I may know all the rules of the game, I may know everything, all the knowledge that is needed about the game, but that doesn't make me a good player. On the other hand, once I enter the field and start playing, even if I don't know the rules, I can still, you know, get the joy of playing, get the experience of playing, and I will definitely be considered as a better sportsman than a person who only knows the rules. In fact, as we are playing, when we discover the rules and learn the rules, I think those rules remain more deeply embedded in us as well. That is how it is when we look at devotees like the Gopikas. it, I think for them the reverse happened. They were definitely epitomes of knowledge. That is why when Krishna sends, what is the messenger he sends?
Uddhava.
Uddhava to go and advise the Gopikas. Uddhava comes back learning a lot from the Gopikas. How is it that the Gopikas were able to educate a person who is as learned and as wise as Uddhava? It's because, like I said, they were in the game. They have played the game. They have, entered the field. And in the process, the wisdom has entered them. Experience leading to wisdom rather than knowledge seeking experience. So that is why I think it becomes very important when Swami says that once you know it, it's more important that you practice it. You practice it. Because on one hand, it helps us to build our confidence. And on the other hand, it is the practice. It is the practical that makes the theory more sound. That helps us understand better what was possibly only theoretical knowledge.
And I think we had done an entire series on Swami's that four-step process to self-realization. Swami would say self-confidence, self-sacrifice. And that we had spoken at length about what Swami says about self-confidence. And especially when you talk about self-sacrifice, that's, I think, quite understandable. You know, when you talk about a noble nature, when you talk about spiritual life, sacrifice seems to be something which you can come to terms with. Even satisfaction, you know that, you know, contentment and peace is so intertwined, and you cannot talk about one without talking about the other. But self-confidence sometimes is not such a simple thing to grasp as an important step in the spiritual process. And that's why I know what Swami says is so very important to, after having found out what is the right thing to do it. And when you do it, that confidence which comes that I can make out what is right and wrong. I can discriminate between what is right and wrong. And I think that is, I think, one point which Swami said, which is very important. And that's why many of the things which Swami said the last time was about the mind. There was a question on over-planning, which Swami said there's nothing wrong in the mind over-planning. Not over-planning. There's nothing wrong in the mind planning ahead. In fact, that is one of the important functions of the mind. And then Swami gave the importance of, there was a small passage on the food. I think that's another passage which is coming, or we've completed that part. I don't know where Swami was saying all the thoughts in your mind come from the food.
We completed it. That is also matter. Thoughts is also matter. That was a lovely revelation for us in the last session where we when you realize that thought is also matter, and we referred to the principle of conservation of mass, where, you know, matter can never be created or destroyed. Matter and energy together cannot be created or destroyed. They just transform from one to other. And that is how we realize that even scientifically, it makes a lot of sense. You know, it's not as if whatever Swami says needs scientific backing. Because science is far, 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 far behind. You know, Swami says the end of science is the beginning of spirituality. But when you see science also reaching up to that level, I mean, and in spite of that, if we don't recognize it, it's absolute foolishness, you know. Sometimes because spirituality is beyond the mind, we may not be able to appreciate it or understand it. But science is something that's below the mind. And even when scientifically that is holding true, then it is foolish on our part to disregard it. That is how we learned the importance of the food that we take in. As you said, there were multiple analogies and examples from Vedanta that Bhagwan gave. Possibly that is the reason why the next question from Hislop is, Swami mentions Vedanta. What is the correct use of that word? And Swami replies, Vedanta is metaphysical inquiry of the divine, the world, and the valid experience of each. Metaphysics begins where physics ends. Vedanta proves by experience that which has been formulated. Philosophy is the fruit which has all the parts, whereas Vedanta is the sweet juice. Philosophy takes you to the edge of truth, gives you a vision of the truth. Vedanta takes you into the heart of truth. Philosophy is a way of intellectual inquiry. So Swami answers, and he begins by saying that Vedanta is a metaphysical inquiry of the divine. you know, when I saw this word metaphysics, I just went to read up a little bit about what is metaphysics. I realized that we possibly use this term often. Is there a specific connotation for the term? So metaphysics is basically the study of existence. You know, you ask, why do you exist? Who is existing? You know, it is almost connected to spiritual nanyar or who am I kind of. So what is existing? What is existence? And metaphysics has two branches. If I am not wrong, one is materialism, the other is idealism.
Mm-hmm.
And in idealism, they consider that what truly exists is the emotion, the feeling, and all this. While materialism believes that what exists is the matter. And it's like the East is East and the West is West and the twain never meets. The problem with materialism is it is unable to explain thoughts, feelings, emotions and all that. And the problem with idealism is it's unable to explain the material world. So it goes on and on like that. And that is why I think Swami says that Vedanta is a metaphysical inquiry of the divine. It encapsulates both. I mean, the inquiry of the divine cannot be restricted only to seeing the divine in the world. It cannot be restricted only to either your emotions or your thoughts and feelings. It's a combination of both. And it doesn't stop with just the inquiry. It also goes to the valid experience of each. So, Swami says, I mean, having not experienced it, I can at best quote Swami's words. Swami says that philosophy is like the fruit, but Vedanta is the essence. It is the pure juice devoid of all the fiber, the seeds, whatever. It is the extract. And that is possibly the reason why even a drop of it has so much of meaning and poignancy.
That term metaphysics, of course, you know, as you said, we use it so flippantly without really understanding what it means.
Mm.
And it really, I mean, the way Swami describes Vedanta as metaphysics, I think that's the closest you can describe Vedanta, because, and the analogy of all philosophy being fruit and Vedanta being the fruit juice. In fact, Swami says, the first samukos in 1972 when Swami started,
mm-hmm.
when Swami said, let's have a samukos in Indian culture and spirituality. And that's how it started. And then they suggested to Swami that, Swami, within Indian culture and spirituality, it would be nice if there is a theme. Because Swami had, I think, already made up his mind that it's going to be an annual affair. So they said, every edition can have a theme. So what shall we start with? And Swami said, the foremost important theme in Indian culture and spirituality is Vedas and Vedanta. So mm-hmm. that's why the first samukos was on Vedanta. And extensively Swami has spoken in that, in that series. One of the things which Swami says is, you know, if you look at the Vedas, those who are uninitiated, all of us, when we look at the Vedas, we think Vedas are all about philosophy. Vedas mm-hmm. are all about spiritual life. Actually speaking, the Vedas are not like that. The Vedas are very, very wide in their relevance. They speak about, you know, getting rains on time. They speak about getting child after you're married. They speak about health. They speak about armory. They speak about warfare. So really speaking, it's a book of knowledge which is wide open in a lot of things. And then Swami says, you know, you have the Vedas, then you have the mantras that you chant when you're doing rituals, which are referred to as, I think, samhitas.
Those
samhitas are the mantras that you chant. Brahmanas are, again, the rules that you have to follow when you want to do something, when you have to do a yajnam, when you have to do a naming ceremony and all that. And finally, Swami says the third is the Aranyakas.
Mm.
Literally translated, Aranyakas means the forest books.
Mm.
Which means the same Vedas when you take and you start pondering over it again and again and trying to see what they convey, Swami says that led to Vedanta. When Swami says it's the juice, it's literally the juice. It's like the fruit taken and you remove everything else and you take only the essence. Mm. So that's what is Vedanta. And the beauty is, if you see, the Vedanta consists of all the Upanishads. If you look at the Upanishads, you will find corresponding verses in the Samhitas and the Brahmanas. So which means it'll be taking the same verses and it'll be explaining it in a deeper manner. The same stories will be taken and the inner meaning will be given.
Hmm.
Same dialogues will be taken and, you know, it would be put in a different conversation and the real meaning of that will be given. One story which Swami narrates in one of the summer courses is that of, you know, there's a story of I think it's the story on Devi, where she materializes a grass, you know, a strand of grass, and then she asks all the deities to, you know, either burn it or wet it or blow it, Agni, Indra, and Vayu, and all of them. And none of them are able to do it. That's one. It's a mythological story.
A blade of grass doesn't move without.
The same thing is again explained in the, in the Upanishads as speaking of that is the Atma, and the Atma cannot be touched by all of this. And then that analogy is explained in the whole manner. So that's why Vedanta is literally it. And the beauty is, I mean, I wouldn't say it's beauteous. It speaks very little about devotion. It speaks very little about a personal deity of God and avatar and all of that. Because it is pure metaphysics. It is like if you're asking who is God, it'll say who is asking the question. You know, you start from there. And it's so very simple, and that's the beauty of Vedanta itself. It does not tell you something which is beyond you. It tells you something which is within your grasp which you have not looked at. Like there was a very beautiful explanation that one of the scholars in Vedanta was saying. You know, you look at your hand and you always say, I am looking at my hand. Do you ever say my hand is looking at me? So that very thing means that you are saying that you are conscious and your hand is not conscious. Even though it is your own body. So that difference that you are not the body is so easy to understand, but we have never looked at it that way because we are stuck in physics, we are stuck in the physical dimensions around.
And not only that, it also goes to the nuances of language because, for instance, I'm just picturing if there were a pair of eyes on my hand, I would say that the hand is also looking at me. But that's why I say possibly that I am looking at my hand and the hand is not looking at me. But that in turn inspires another question as to when the eye is, if you say that it is the eye that ensures that you are looking, there are creatures in the world without eyes that can see. And at the same time, even with eyes, we do not see. So there is the question of when there are eyes, what is it that is seeing? Who is seeing? What is it that energizes the eye to see? So as you said, Vedanta goes only to the essence and it almost hits home on the point. That's it. That is why sometimes it will be ununderstandable or it might be considered as being too brief. And that is the reason you have the other scriptures that expound on the same Vedanta, and we have Vedantic analogies and stories and all that. In fact, the term Vedanta itself, you know, Anta is like the finality, the goal, the ultimate. The ultimate of the Vedas is in the Vedanta. And I would just like to add a few more sentences to when you said that Vedas are not just mantras. You know, what you said is the general understanding of the Vedas. I don't think even that holds good. When we tell people Vedas, we just think of a few mantras that need to be chanted. Right. Vedas are confined to being a few incantations which possibly can get some benefit to us. But it is not. Vedas is like the book of creation itself. It has all the knowledge. You know, as you said, Ayurveda, medicine comes from Vedas. The first surgeries have been done even before the so-called modern tools were out. You know, Ayurvedic surgeries were the first ones to be done. There is knowledge on warfare. There is knowledge on everything. It's just that it's not studied enough. We have not dwelt into depth enough. And that's why we possibly think that Vedas are just the mantras. And if the Vedas contain the whole world, all the knowledge of the world in it, the Vedanta is the ultimate knowledge in the knowledge of the world. Yes, everything is knowledge. You know, knowing how to put a plug into the point and put on the switch is also knowledge. Knowing how to fly a jet aircraft is also knowledge. But when we consider everything as knowledge, we definitely know that there is some knowledge that is higher than the other knowledge. And Vedanta is supposed to be the highest knowledge. And because it is the distillate of all the knowledge that is there. And that is what Swami says. Then Hislop asks the question, Swami speaks of the divine, the world and the individual. What is the relationship of Swami to the individual? And Swami replies, Swami is the activator of the individual. He is the I, the self in you and in everyone else. The sun is reflected in the water and the water becomes warm. Yet warmth is not in the water's nature. That provokes Hislop into asking, what then is the difference between God and the world? And Swami says, only in words, in the mind, is there a difference. When one is fully devoted to God, desiring Him only, the verbal and conceptual differentiation will cease, and the world also will be seen as God. The sequence should be experienced and seen as God, life, world. But most people see the world, life, and God is far distant.
Yeah, I think this is probably the most complex part, and the question which the Hislop asks is probably the question which defines what you refer to as Hindu philosophy, or you know, the schools of belief.
Mm.
What is the relationship between God, the world, and man?
Mm.
Right? All your Sankhya philosophy, your Advaita Vedanta or Vishishta Advaita Vedanta, it's all about how do they solve this problem, or what is their answer to this problem.
Mm.
And one thing, when you read this answer which Swami is giving, and of course the answers which Swami has given so far and elsewhere and all of that, Swami does not prescribe to any one of those schools of thought, or any does not say that only that is true and this is not true.
Mm.
The answer which Swami is giving is purely Advaita, pure Shankara's philosophy of, you know, what he says, the central line of Shankara's philosophy, Jivo Devana Apara. He said the individual and the Lord are not separate.
Hmm.
And the world is only a Maya. There's nothing, but it is meant to appear to be there, but it is not there. So the philosophy which Swami is giving, the answer which Swami is giving is Advaita, but elsewhere, whatever Swami has spoken, Swami spoke so much in the previous one about devotion being important.
Mm.
Right? And going forward, Swami is going to speak about the importance of having a form to worship, a name to call upon. Mm. So that again, that becomes Dvaita philosophy. Right? So Swami does not prescribe to anyone. It is like the goal is one. At any point, whatever works for you, whatever is taking you closer to that goal, mm. whatever is making you more pure, is a valid tool to use, is a valid path to take at that point in time. It almost looks like it, but this is a fundamental question that Swami is saying, that only in words there are these differences. But otherwise there is no difference at all. And I think that's the basis of the Advaita philosophy itself.
And one thing that becomes very clear to me at least is that we need to experience this to understand it. Because, you know, when you read it as words here again, when Swami says, only in words, in the mind there's a difference. You know, otherwise if you are fully devoted to God, desiring Him only, then the verbal and conceptual differentiation will cease. I mean, you won't be able to see the difference between a table and a chair and a glass. And you just wonder, how is that possible? But as Swami says it clearly here, you have to be fully devoted to God, desiring Him only. Now, if that is the if condition in order to be able to do this, what sadly happens is we never fulfill that if condition and just keep questioning this again and again. How is it possible? It doesn't seem logical. It is being said, if you do this, this will happen. This is what you will like. And once you experience it, I think once you experience, then you don't need anything else. You may not be able to, you yourself might not be able to explain it. Like, you know, the common example that is given is like the taste of sugar. If somebody has never tasted sugar in his life, he is put in a room with a person who is very good at communication and he has tasted all kinds of sugar, all kinds of sweet, all his life. Even in that scenario, the good communicator will not be able to communicate to the person what sugar is, irrespective of how much ever he tries. In fact, it might lead to the other person concluding that, I think this person has also not tasted sugar, or he is not a good communicator because he is just not able to make me understand. All that the communicator needs to do is just pick up a spoonful of sugar and thrust it into this person's mouth and say, did you understand? The understanding that is got by the experience would be so complete and comprehensive and wholesome that after that, no need of any more explanation at all. In fact, after consuming it, possibly that this person will now be able to appreciate better all the explanations that was given to him so far. So that is why it is so important. You know, we started off also by saying how Swami says the practice is so important, because it is the practice that completes the knowledge. Otherwise, the knowledge is half-baked at best. And again, I'm saying this based on the experience that we have narrated many times here of Bhagya sir, when, you know, he kept yearning, telling Swami that he has come here only with the objective of spiritual progress and growth, and he was granted an experience briefly for a couple of days where he was able to, you know, if we can say, see the world with this Advaitic vision. And when you ask Bhagya sir about those 2 days of experience, he says that it's only after he came out of the experience he got to know that it was for 2 days, because he said he had no concept of time. He said that he didn't see the mandir as separate, Swami coming for darshan. He says that everywhere it was only me. In a part of me there was the mandir. I mean, you know, he's telling that the mandir is in him. And in the mandir, Swami is there going about doing his duty. It, again, when he's explaining the experience, for a person who has not experienced like me or any of the other listeners, it again seems very strange. It is just as strange as a person who has tasted sugar trying to explain what is that sweetness. You know, on your tongue as you put it, you'll have saliva coming from all sides and a kind of joy will go through. And you know, how else will you explain sweet to a person who has not had sweet? And you feel like closing your eyes and telling like that. And you suddenly feel a surge of energy within you. I mean, for all that you know, instead of describing the taste of sugar, I might be describing this experience. Because this is how Bhagya sir described. And he said all that happened, and even to this day, the sole goal of his life is to get that Advaitic vision. And that has got enhanced because of this experience. So finally it comes down to the experience. That's why, you know, when we read all this, when we read this, when Swami says that all the difference is just in words and your mind, actually there is nothing. There is a part of us, or maybe a complete whole of us, which says, come on Swami, simply you are giving statements and you are making statements which easy to make, but we don't understand. Yes, we don't understand because we are not experienced. We have to yearn and do intense sadhana, get that experience once, and after that, everything will be known. We'll see that ahead also, because when the questions start coming at a rapid rate and so many from multiple people, Swami's answer finally comes down to, but you find out who you are. It's almost like you find out that one, get that one experience. I'm saying this because even for Bhagya sir, it was the same quest. The quest of who am I? Swami asked him, who am I? And he said, Swami, you are the Jagat Guru. Swami said, no, who am I? Find out. He said, Swami, what is there to find out? I know, you are the Supreme Godhead. Swami said, not that, find out who am I. You know, Bhagya sir had come fresh, new to Swami. And how beautifully Swami works these things is, as he walks out, an elderly devotee comes to him and hands him a book, the title of which is Who Am I by Ramana Maharshi. So he was so thrilled. And see, that is how it is. He began his search with Who Am I and got all the understanding and experience. So too, Swami, we'll see that later, that Swami also says that is it. Find out that. All the answers lie in getting the answer to that one question.
You know, it's very interesting. Even as I was saying, that answer is so pure in Advaita, in that relationship between God, individual and the world. But then Swami says it all starts with that desire for God. As very beautifully Swami puts it, it's the sequence that you've got it wrong. First you seek God and then you'll find Him in everything that you come across. And in fact, just backtracking about again what Vedanta is and what the Aranyakas are. The essence behind that idea, why they are called Aranyakas, why they're called forest books, and why they were able to find this essence of Vedanta, which is nothing but everything that you see is divine. They say that, you know, here is this treasure in front of you, and the treasure is here to answer all your immediate needs, you know, all your worldly needs. You want progeny, it's there. If you want a good crop, it's there. If you want to be more powerful, it is there. When you're able to go beyond all of that and say that I don't want all of this, you're in a state where you're able to denounce and be detached from all of that, and that is what was represented by the forest. It's not like you go sit in the forest and read the Veda, you'll find the Vedanta. It is when you give up all the, you know, the luxuries that the society offers, in mentally, not even physically, not saying that, you know, I've renounced it, become a sannyasi. When you transcend that desire, then you're able to find it. And going back to the example of Bhagya sir, he used to say that first when he came to Swami, or, you know, initially when he used to come as a devotee, when he was working in Bahrain at that time, he said he had come to a point where the world meant nothing to him. That, you know, he was just craving for that opportunity to come and serve Swami. And he was saying that, you know, for me, Namasmarana had become so spontaneous that with every step I'll say, Sai Ram, Sai Ram,
Sai, Sai Ram, Ram, Sai Ram. Ram. Right. Yes, while walking.
He said, you know, I was in that state where the world did not mean anything, worldly success did not mean anything. And at a point when he gave up that and came, you know, he was very close to the person who was a senior and, who was one of the royal family. He was in a stage in his career where he was very powerful, very influential. And
Prem, just to add on, not only was he at the zenith of worldly success, before coming, if I remember right, it was in Amsterdam, mm-hmm. where it was chill and some problem was there where he had to walk in the rain. He said, "I will walk, Swami, with your name." And he said that as he said, "Sai Ram, Sai Ram," and he was walking, on his side, he saw Swami also walking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, physically, he's seeing Swami walking by his side. And so, it is not just that he was at his worldly zenith. He is also having these phenomenal spiritual experiences. But the way he says is that even though you may get spiritually phenomenal experiences, they too are a kind of a worldly thing only. It will not lead to that ultimate satisfaction till you are deeply rooted in this knowledge or wisdom that everything is one. You will remain dissatisfied. And partially, I'm sure both of us can agree to him, because not just both of us, anybody, because all of us have had some or the other experience with Swami. Miraculous ones, touching ones, loving ones. And in spite of all that, it is not as if we feel fulfilled and complete, and we are not in that state of, permanent peaceful exuberance, if I can call it that way. We are not there like that. So if our experiences could not grant that, we can understand, extrapolate and understand that no experience is going to grant that till we are able to remain in that state permanently.
Exactly. And you know, that is the progression that Swami was taking somebody like him to. That when you have a form in front of you, or when you have God and you have devotion for him, that will actually make you transcend this difference which is there between the world and divinity and yourself. As Swami is saying, that craving and that love is what is going to take you to that next step. In fact, there is that very, very beautiful episode from the life of Saint Tukaram. I'm sure we might have narrated it before, where, you know, he has this habit of going to a particular place in the village or the central part of the village, and he would feed the sparrows which would come. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, he would take all his time out and, you know, go away from the people. He would sit and write abhangs. And he found a lot of solace going there and, you know, feeding all those birds. So he would see that whenever he would go there, you know, the birds will be sitting down. Somebody would have already put grains there. But when he goes there, they'll all fly away. And that's a very common thing. It happens with everybody, you know, who goes there. So then at one point, it seems Tukaram starts thinking. He says, "Vitala, why is this happening? See, I claim that I have filled my heart with your love. And it is your love which is there in all these beings. So if I really have filled my heart with your love, no other being should be afraid of me or should be disturbed by my presence. The very fact that these birds are flying away when I come in their presence means I have not perfected my love for you." And, you know, he's standing there, he starts weeping like a child, because that is the most sad thing for him. It is not that he's poor, it's not that, you know, people don't like him or people are making fun of him. He said that thought that I have not loved you properly, because this is a sign of that. And he stands there and he starts crying, and as he's shedding tears, one bird comes and sits on him. Mm-hmm. And within the next few minutes, one after the other, and all the birds come and sit right on him, not around him. And wow. At that moment, he loses himself in that bliss. You know, it was like what Swami is saying here, that moment you have reached that state through your love for God, you automatically transcend that. In fact, there's one very, very beautiful abhang which he writes, I think, much later. And Swami would quote some of these abhangs like this and say that, you know, you look at Tukaram as a devotee, but look at the views that he is expressing. Because, you know, it is, I think in Jnanavaini, Swami says, when devotion fructifies, it becomes jnana. Mm. And, you know, there's this padyam, there's a abhang which he writes where he says, "Smaller than the smallest atom and infinite like the sky is Tuka. I swallowed my body and this delusory form of the entire universe with it." He says, I swallowed my body, which means I transcended this body.
Consciousness. Mm.
And with it, the existence of the universe also was transcended. It was not just my body I transcended. He says, I swallowed my body and this delusory form of the entire universe with it. I gave up the triad and the self-effulgent supreme revealed itself like a lamp is lit in the pot. And the triad that he is referring to, which is people have commented on it, have spoken of it as the knower, known and knowledge. That's usually referred to as the triad in Vedanta. Mm. So he says, I gave up the triad and the self-effulgent supreme revealed itself like a lamp is lit in the pot. Which is again a Vedantic example of you light a pot, I mean light a lamp and put a pot over it with a few holes. You know, you see the light coming out of it, but you don't see the lamp itself.
Correct.
Till you break the pot.
Pot.
And that is referred to.
When you break the pot, you realize it's actually the same source.
It's the same source.
Not multiple lights.
Exactly. So he's referring to that. He says, I gave up the triad and the self-effulgent supreme revealed itself like a lamp is lit in the pot. The last line is really beautiful. He says, now this body is called tukha. It remains only for others' welfare. He says, I have transcended body consciousness, but this body continues because it has a certain purpose to fulfill in serving the world around.
Wow. On that note, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break. And on the other side of the break, continue the question and answer sessions in the Conversations with Sai.
Shrimatvadiya Charitamrita Mannayarya Pitva Pinaiva Suhita Manuja Veyuhu Pitva Pinaiva Suhita Manuja Baneyuhu Tvam Venkata Chalapatiriva Bhakti Saram Tvam Venkata Chalapatiriva Bhakti Saram Sri Namo Namaste Namo Namaste Tandanana hi Tandanana pure Tandanana bala Tandanana bala Tandanana bala Tandanana Tandanana hi Tandanana pure Tandanana bala tandanana bala tandanana bala tandanana Brahma mukkate para Brahma mukkate tandanana hi tandanana pure tandanana Shrihare Antaratma Kanduva Guhinadika Mulindulevu Andarike Shrihare Antaratma Hare Antaratma Shrihare Antaratma Indulo Jantukula Mantanu Okate Andarike Shrihare Antaratma Hare Antaratma Shrihare అంటనే పంటు నిద్ర దేయునొకటే నిండార రాజు నిద్రించు నిద్రయునొకటే అంటనే పంటు నిద్ర దేయునొకటే మెండైన బ్రాహ్మణుడు మెట్టు భూమి ఒకటే చండాలుడుండేటి సరి భూమి ఒకటే మెండైన బ్రాహ్మణుడు మెట్టు భూమి ఒకటే చండాలుడు Tandanana hi, Tandanana pure, Tandanana vala. రంగులయు ఎండొకటే కడలియేను మీద కాయు ఎండొకటే పుడమి సునకము మీద బొడయు ఎండొకటే కడు పుణ్యులగు పాప కర్ములను సరిగా జడియు శ్రీకడేశ్వరు నామొకటే కడు పుణ్యులగు పాప కర్ములను సరిగా జడియు శ్రీకడేశ్వరు నామొకటే తందనానాగి తందనాన పురే తందనాన బడ తందనాన బడ తందనాన బడ తందనాన బ్రహ్మమొకటే పద బ్రహ్మమొక్కటే పద బ్రహ్మమొక్కటే పర బ్రహ్మమొక్కటే పర బ్రహ్మమొక్కటే తందనానాహి తందనాన పురే తందనాన బళ 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 తందనాన.
Welcome back, dear listeners. The conversation continues with a visitor now asking Swami, why is creation? What is the reason for it? And Swami replies, first ask, why food? No reason. Why marriage? No reason. Then children, why children? No reason. It is your wish. Creation is God's wish, His sankalpa. There is a seed of a tree. It sprouts and there are many twigs and branches and more thousands of leaves grow and hundreds of fruits, diversity, all from a single seed. The visitor continues, but what is behind creation? What is the reason? And Swami replies, first ask, who are you? Visitor doesn't give up. He continues, I'm a nobody. Swami says, no. Who are you? First find that. And then you will find the answer to your question. So, you know, what we are saying, it is amazing because, you know, the other master whom Swami also mentioned in a positive light, I think is Nisargadatta Maharaj. And he is an Advaitin philosopher. And if we read through his works also, not that I have gone through, but whatever I have heard from people, becomes clear that any question that is asked of him, somehow ultimately it comes back to you finding out who you are. And two, three questions that I have heard being read out to me or being, you know, when we are discussing, it feels very strange that it doesn't matter what you ask him, finally he's going to come to this. That is how it is, that when that is happening repeatedly, it just must mean that that is the truth. Because here also Swami is saying, don't try to go like that. Don't, the route that you are taking to find out the answer is wrong. That will not work. You can then, you know, gather knowledge for lifetimes and yet you will not get the answer. Instead of that, focus on this one. Get this one answer and everything else is understood. I think that is what Swami is trying to tell him. Ask the right questions because It is well known that spirituality is not about the answers, it's about asking the right questions. If we get the question right, then the understanding comes. So, Swami is trying to direct this person who is asking the question to ask the right question. Don't ask about why creation, how the planets, no. That is how possibly science is also going outward. I mean, go inward, find out who you are, everything else will make sense. Everything, you'll get the understanding. And here, as devotees, we have to take Swami's word with faith because, again, going back to the sugar eating example, it is an experience that you have to get and then you will get the understanding. Without the experience, how much ever with love and patience and knowledge it is explained, it won't make sense. So, Swami is trying to divert us to the right question, telling you find out who you are, forget all the other questions. In fact, you know, as a slight aside, this kind of question, I remember when I was doing my second year post-graduation, our awareness teacher was Professor G.V. Venkatraman sir. He would come and take awareness classes and it was an amazing experience to sit through his classes. When he would throw the class open for questions, one or two randomly would get up and shoot these questions, you know. Sir, why did God create the world? And why did God have to make only one planet with life? Why couldn't he make multiple planets with life? You know, these questions, I think, when it would be asked, what Professor G, I don't remember if he gave any other answer, but one thing he directly indicated was, you have been given this human life, which is a great extreme rarity, to find out a great truth. Ask questions that help you move towards that truth. And he said, you will know that because that is what I think, you know, was referred as the difference between Prashna and Pariprashna. Prashna is a question that you ask possibly to check whether the one who is answering knows the answer or not, or you know the answer and whether he knows it as well or how different it is from your answer. That is like idle questioning. A Pariprashna is a question whose answer you need because you feel that if you don't get that answer, you can't live. I mean, you don't feel like eating food if you don't know that answer. You don't feel like doing anything else if you don't get that answer. You are yearning and craving for that answer. So that is what is needed. And I think GV sir guided us along that line, saying that ask for such questions. Ask questions that you know is genuinely going to benefit you. Imagine that you are told you can ask only three questions and only three answers will be given to you. Will this be a question in that? So I think that is what GV sir did to us in the awareness class that day. And I think that is what Swami is also doing here. Precisely that you ask the right kind of questions. Don't keep asking all other questions because there is no end to that otherwise.
A couple of things which comes to my mind when Swami is answering this question. There is a discourse where he speaks about this. I think it's a question which comes for anybody who starts the process of inquiry.
Hmm.
One youngster once had asked me when I had the discussion with them, Swami says that I separated myself from myself to love myself.
Mm.
Probably so that I get back to myself, because that's the whole idea. You go back to the source. Why the trouble then? Right? If the whole idea was that one should merge back into the source, then why the separation at all? That seems like a simple question, because one thing is our logical mind is, you know, anything, you create a gadget, why was this gadget created is actually a question. If answered, will also answer the question, how can I use it?
Hmm.
Right? Because the purpose behind creation is also the purpose of utility of what has been created. Hmm. But the thing is, there are some, you know, especially some of these mind experiments or psychological experiments which they do, which actually works when the reason is not told. Something like if you want to study the placebo effect, you cannot tell the participants that you're trying to study the placebo effect and give them medicine. That's never going to work, right?
For our listeners who don't know what is the placebo effect, a placebo is something that is given like medicine, which looks like medicine, smells like medicine, but is not the medicine. Just to see whether medicine is actually a material,
right,
or whether it is the feeling and faith. I mean, whether it is again materialism or idealism.
Right. So you cannot, I mean, the idea behind the experiment will not help doing the experiment or something like that, if you can put it, because Swami, in one of the discourses, he says, you know, there is this grain, a very beautiful example that Swami gives. You have a grain.
Mm-hmm.
If there is husk around the grain, then Swami says it can still sprout. Right. If you remove the husk, then it becomes rice. Right.
Mm.
So then Swami gives the example of the husk being desire, and as long as there's desire, there's going to be rebirth and rebirth. And you remove the husk, then it becomes rice. You know, even if you put it in ground, it's not going to sprout again. So Swami says, like that, every seed has come from a tree. That tree has come from another seed. You have a seed in your hand. What is the point in asking who is the father of this seed, who is the grandfather of the seed, who is the first ancestor of the seed? Swami says it's of no use. You take the seed and chew it in your mouth, you'll put an end to that seed from there. There's not going to be another tree from there.
Mm.
So Swami says this lifetime which has been given to you is a seed. Don't wonder which is the tree from which the seed has come and which is the tree, a seed from which that tree has come. You have an opportunity to put an end to the cycle now. Concentrate on that. Right? That's one point which came to my mind. The other one is like Swami speaking about sankalpa. Swami saying there's no reason for many things. I was reminded of a very simple scene which happened just actually outside my building. There is this small passageway which leads to my building.
Mm-hmm.
And it has got two gates on either end of the passage. at which is never closed, which is always left open, because people keep going through that passage all through the day. So one day when I came down my building and I was about to take that passage, I found that the gate was closed, right? And just behind me was another elderly lady. And I saw the gate closed, and if it's closed, it could only mean that there's some work which is going on in the passageway. I looked and there was nobody there. It was completely empty. And I looked to the other side and there were some children playing there. So the moment I saw them, I realized that they must have closed the door and they would close the gate, and they must have been playing on the gate or something like that. So just one look at the scene, anybody would have got it that must have happened. So you just have to open the gate and you have to go. Right? And just behind me was this elderly lady who came in front of me, and she said, "Why is the gate closed?" So I told her, "No, the children must have been playing, they must have closed it. But why is the gate closed?" And I thought, there is no reason. The moment you say children are playing, why do children do certain thing while they're playing? I mean, there is no answer to that.
They felt like doing.
They just do what they do during the play. And I think that's the beauty, because in Vedanta, we always use the word leela for creation. Why did God create? It's a leela, because a play does not have a reason. What one does playfully, the reason why you're saying that God did it playfully is because you don't know a reason beyond that.
You know, it reminds me of a theme that I had received as part of the Pick and Speak competition.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, the theme was, God loves fun. So I was thinking of what to speak about it. And I think, let me say in the beginning that the speech turned out to be a flop, a failure, because I think everyone expected me to speak of some humorous incidents involving Swami, being a competition in Swami's college. But somehow that day, I don't know, I was in a different zone, and the theme that came, even to this day, I feel it's a very beautiful thought and I would like to share it. What I spoke about that day was a child that I saw playing on the beach. Once I saw this child, and the child was digging up the sand, and you know, he was there and he was making some kind of a sculpture on the beach, and in his opinion, it was the most marvelous creation, but it just looked like a mound for me. But from whatever he was speaking, I could make out that he's thinking it as a palace, a home, and he's building all of that. However good it looked, or however bad it looked, it definitely took about half an hour of effort for him. And I was really admiring his patience and perseverance in, because after he started building, the tide also began to come in.
Mm-hmm.
It would come, and I thought that in another half an hour or 1 hour's time, it would destroy his creation. So what he did is, he went to the other side and he started heaping up mud like a wall, you know, like a bund, whatever. I mean, I don't think that would also stop the sea for much longer time. But he made whatever he thought can protect his palace and castle. But the most unthinkable thing, unthinkable, I feel it's because I'm an adult, that happened was, after doing all that, his mother or father or somebody, some adult was there, said, chalo, it's time to go, we have to go. He says, okay, we have to go. He turns, runs in all his speed and lands on this whole creation, lands on that whole whatever palace or thing he has built, just raises it to the ground. And I thought, you're crazy or what? I mean, for what did you do? And then he's smiling, he's so happy that he did it, and he went off. When I was thinking of it, I was thinking, maybe this is how God does his creation with the sands of time, you know. He creates, and even, you know, we have Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara. Swami says G-O-D stands for generation, organization and destruction. It is creation, sustenance and destroying. All the three I saw this child doing. He was creating it, and then fearing the ocean, he was building protection and trying to sustain it. And if you thought that his goal was to create and sustain, he brings it down, raises it to dust the next moment. And, you know, I think I didn't get an opportunity to ask. I think that if I had actually gone and asked the child, why did you do what you did? I think his answer would have just been, if he could express, he would have just said, I just felt like doing it. That's all. I mean, no reason for love, no season for love, they say. No, I mean, that's the way. I don't know. I just felt like doing it. I did it. So as you rightly said, when you said child, this got triggered in me. In fact, in that speech, that's what I said. When I spoke about God loving fun, I said God does everything for fun, because for him everything is a leela. He just felt like doing it. It was fun. It was fun for him to create. It was fun for him to protect. It was fun for him to destroy. And nothing has happened, because there's enough sand to create how many or more castles. We don't cry over a castle that's gone. We don't celebrate a castle that has come. It's just, you know, time pass. Pastime. So this is what got triggered, and that's why I feel it's no use asking why for all these questions. Why the creation? Why did God have to separate himself from himself when he had to go back then? I don't know, but having seen so many things in the world, we see everything is cyclical. You know, if I ask what is the... it almost looks like for any life... life itself, there is movement that is necessary. Look at the ocean current, they keep going circle in the same way. The earth keeps going around the sun. What is the purpose? If you ask, why does the earth have to move if it's going to land up in the same point next year? The sun keeps going around something. Everything is cyclical. You know, everything, life, birth, death, don't know. I mean, as an adult, that's what I think. Why the cycle of creation, sustenance and destruction? Just like everything is in cycle, that's also a cycle. I just don't know. But I feel that's possibly the wrong question to ask if I'm looking for the ultimate state. Yeah, as you said, we begin off by these questions, but then we try to focus on to those questions which are definitely going to matter. Which I feel that if I don't know the answer of which, I won't get sleep, I won't be able to live, I won't be able to sustain. We have to evolve from prashna to pariprashna.
And the other thing is, you know, the very fact that Swami is ask who are you? It's not that the answer to that question is easy. It's not that it's a simple question that today you ask a question and by evening fall you'll get an answer to that. Right? But the way Swami is putting it is that is a more worthwhile quest to have rather than this. I mean, going back to Nisargadatta Maharaj, as you were saying, all his questions... all his answers will be a question. If you ask him a question, like a disciple comes to him and he'll ask him, so what have you come here for? This is shared by one of the elders who were, you know, physically in his presence. So he looked at him and asked, what have you come here for? So he says, I want to know who I am. And any guesses what his question was?
Then why did you come to me?
He asked, who wants to know? he asked him, inquire, who is the person who has this question? Who wants to know this question? Who wants to know the answer to this question? And literally, it's that's all it takes. You just constantly keep asking this question. But if you look at it, you know, each one of us, it is within the understanding of our own level of understanding. Let's say I am a chartered accountant or something, and I have an Excel sheet in front of me. I am putting, you know, whatever accountant or your debits and credits, and you're putting some numbers in one column, some numbers in another column. Let's say a child walks up to you and looks at the screen and asks, why are you putting this number here and not putting it there? There are so many columns empty here. Why don't you put it here? Why are you putting it there? Right? It's a very innocuous question. There is an answer to that, but right now you're not in a state to understand the answer to that why. Right? So if you look at it that way, probably there is an answer to this question, why creation? But right now in my understanding, that why... even if there is an answer, I do not have the understanding to grasp it. This question of who am I, when Swami says ask this question, it means that this is within syllabus. This is something, and if you do not finish this, you cannot, you know, come to the level of the accountant and understand the spreadsheet in front of you.
And the beautiful thing is, I think this question, who am I, has different connotations and meanings in every class. It is in syllabus for every class.
Right.
Like when you say the Excel sheet, depending on the age of the child, if the child asks, why are you not putting it in this block? You can either ask, do you know what is number? Let me teach you what is 1, what is 2. Or if it is a child is a little higher, you ask, you know, what is 1 plus 2? Do you know that? Try to find out that first. The child will know, I am asking you why you are not putting in that empty block. You are telling me, find out what is 1 plus 2. No, you find out that. If it's a little more, well, do you know what's a computer software? You know, what is a computer, how it works? You find out that. So, but I think with this analogy and example, when we go back to the question, who am I, depending on whatever be our stage of spiritual development, I think asking this question makes a lot of sense, and it starts prodding us along the spiritual journey. And that is why to various people, means be it even a child from primary school, in his own different way. Swami, you know, by saying that, no, all our brothers, all our sisters, all are this, there's nobody. You know, different ways to devotees, to students, whoever it is, irrespective of age, gender, irrespective of inclination. Swami has, you know, if I can say, prescribed this question as the question to be asked. It just makes one feel that possibly this who am I is a question that is apt for everyone, irrespective of spiritual leanings, irrespective of age, irrespective of understanding. Start off with this question and keep pursuing this question till the end.
And going back to Nisargadatta Maharaj, one more thing which he would say is, ask this question, who am I? Whichever answer comes, discard it. Because as you're saying, that every answer is only to a certain level, right? To constantly ask, you know, if you're a student of 4th standard, you have a certain question to ask. If you're a student of 10th standard, you still have a certain question to ask. So the answer that you get will vary based on your level. But till that answer or till the question does not rise again, till you're absolutely satisfied with the answer that you have found, you have to keep asking that question is what, and you can make out the difference in understanding from the visitor, because when Swami says, who are you? He says, I am nobody. Probably he meant that, you know.
I'm nobody, Swami. I'm nobody.
It's not that, you know, I have the right to ask you this question. I'm a simple person. Swami's like, so you know, that is probably the antithesis of whatever Swami is trying to drive in here.
Exactly. Because as I said, even Bhagya sir, he says that when Swami first asked, who are you? Do you find out who am I? He said, Swami, I know. You're the avatar, Swami.
Right. And like that, this person, Swami is trying to tell him that you're divine. He's saying that, no, I'm a nobody.
And then, you know, after that question, the visitor then asks again, you know, he says, is there life on other planets? He's just what I was referring to. And Swami answers him saying, creation is endless. At this point in time, I think Hislop steps in out of his mercy for Swami. He says, Swami, is it that man creates his world by projecting concepts? For example, table is not real. It is a wood that forms the table that is real. Yet we accept the concept table as being real and we act according to that concept. So his question is it that man is creating the world by projecting his own concepts? And Swami answers, table is wood and table is a projection of the human mind. It's both. And table is only temporary. But the image in the mind is in the nature of an archetype. Likewise, castles in clouds are passing phenomena. But God is their base. Just as waves, spray and bubbles arising from the ocean fall away and disappear, but the ocean does not disappear.
Again, the quintessential Dvaitic or Vedantic explanation which Swami is giving here is just that go to that which is more, you know, permanent. As Swami would so often say, just like how asking that question, who am I, is so fundamental to the spiritual inquiry. Swami would say that nitya nityatam. They constantly ask what is real and what is unreal. Because what is unreal or what is short-lived, that is probably a more accurate definition of that word. What is short-lived? As Swami so beautifully says here, the waves are short-lived. If you have a table, we have a table in front of us. Its form as a table is short-lived.
Wood is more permanent.
Probably it might be here for 100 years as a table. It might be used for 100 years as a table. But in the context of endless time, 100 years is probably like the lifetime of a wave in the ocean when you're seeing it. In reference to your half an hour or 1 hour, what a wave's lifetime is what the lifetime of this utility, which we call a table, is in that endless time.
And going deeper, if you say that it is wood, yes, correct, it is wood for a longer period than it's a table. But even then, it became wood at some point in time when it came from a tree.
Right.
And it is going to disintegrate. So you go deeper. You say, no, that is neither table nor wood. It is actually carbon.
Right.
You know, but then again, if you go carbon again, it goes. That is how it goes on deeper. In fact, I was reading the other day saying that a fact which said that, do you know that it is possible that part of you was actually part of who is that famous, what I forget, that queen of Egypt, the famous
Cleopatra.
Mm-hmm. For all that you know, a part of you is a part of Cleopatra. And how they say that, yeah, the carbon atoms, because the number of carbon atoms, hydrogen atoms, oxygen atoms, all this is constant in the earth. In the earth, it's a closed system. And therefore, you know, it is only getting recycled. So, that is what it is.
In fact, putting it in Professor G.V.'s words, he would say that there are some minerals in the body which were only formed during the Big Bang. Mm-hmm. Which means you still have that part of that stardust which was formed when the Big Bang was created.
Wow.
Right? So, when you say that I'm only 20 years old, I'm only 30 years old, how scientifically, factually, that is incorrect.
Even if you say, I'm not talking about me, but I'm talking about my body, even scientifically, which part of your body? Because that element, is there, that metal there, as you said, iron is one metal that G.V. sir would often speak of, which has come from that time. So it is so old. So when you say, I'm only 20 years old, what do you mean?
Exactly. And that is that concept of, you know, Adhara and Adheya, as Swami would say. Then one of the explanations that Vedanta usually gives is, you always have a basis for something which is coming and going. And something like, you know, if you have a tree, for the tree to stand, you need to have an earth. For the earth to be, you need to have a galaxy. For the galaxy to be, you need to have that larger universe. So like that, when you go one step behind each one of this, they say that there must be something which is more permanent than everything that you see, on which all of this is based. And they say that that must be God.
The same way, this is a table, but the table depends on the wood, because without the wood is the basis for the table. But for the wood, there is a basis, and it goes on deeper and deeper.
Right.
We can dig. You know, another way I was thinking of the same thing, Prem, is that when I look at this, what is in front of me, and I say it's a table, it's because of my conditioning.
Right.
You know, possibly if I get, if I have not been taught that. That's why it so happens that when we go abroad, at some place I was even confused by their dustbin, you know, because it is so fancy and different. I have never seen a dustbin like that, so I don't know it is a dustbin. Though I know what is a dustbin, though when I see it, I can recognize. It is because the conditioning comes so much into play, and that is what actually later also, you know, Swami emphasizes on that I call this table a table because I have been taught that it is a table. You know, why do I call a cat a cat? Why do I call an elephant? It's because I have been shown and told that this elephant. And it is my conditioning that makes me see. If some other place a child has been taught that it's a cow, I think there the children will be calling the elephant as a cow. You know, these are just terms by which we denote and we train ourselves. Now, I was just thinking, just imagine that as children when we are taught, we are shown and said, this is God. Instead of teaching a child, if we had taught the child that, instead of saying that there's a table, you say that is God. It is God. I'm sure if that way conditioning would have happened, automatically it would have felt natural for us. See, if I had been conditioned that way as a child, it would be very natural for me to say anything as God only. It is our conditioning that makes us see different things as different. And that is why Swami is saying, the table is wood, and the table is projection of the human mind. It's a combination of both. But that is only temporary. And so, Swami says, it is like castles in the clouds which are passing phenomena. God is the base. Just like waves, spray and bubbles arising from ocean fall away, and the ocean is the base. So, that is what Swami answers. To which Hislop then again says, Swami once said that the world emerges outward from man, just as human beings emerge outward from the body of the mother. Does this mean that the entire world of which we are aware, everything? And Swami says, there is one exception. There is one thing that comes into the man from outside. That thing is the ego, which is formed by attachment to outside objects. With desire for the world cut, ego automatically vanishes. Impressions that are taken into man from outside, if taken as the reality, are harmful. Because man looks at something outside and then creates. He thinks he is reproducing the outside. Whereas in fact, the outside thing seen merely recalls to memory that which is already within.
And it's similar to, I think, what you were saying. You know, the very conditioning is what makes us see what we are seeing in front of us.
Mm.
Right? Many times we wouldn't have noticed something like that unless we've been told that this is what you need to look for.
Correct.
And, you know, many times in a picture we miss out things which are there because we are not told to look for something of that nature. But even before that, you know, this is very, very fascinating what Swami says. Swami would often say this, the whole world is a projection of your mind and you see it because you're there.
Mm.
But so very beautifully Swami says only ahankara comes from outside. And it's a very, very subtle point which I think Swami has spoken about in one of the earlier chapters also, where he spoke about sleep and dream and all of that.
Mm.
Where Swami says your real state is in that deep sleep state.
Mm.
That deep sleep state is when you're completely cut off from the world, and that's where you don't have the ego at all.
Mm.
So the fact when Swami says that ego comes because of your interaction with the outside world, because from the outside world it comes in, it shows that it is not your nature. The moment you start seeing the world, the question that he asked earlier, this is the world, this is another person, this is creation, this is divinity. That difference is what creates the ahankara. And Swami says then you start getting attached to some things, then you start getting averse to some things, and that is what actually strengthens that ego. So very beautiful, Swami says everything else is projected. And then after having projected it, you strengthen this ego through what has been projected from within. It's probably a little subtle and complex for us to understand. But, you know, in parts, it is Swami is so consistent with whatever he has been telling in the Gita, whatever he's been telling in Vedanta in that sense.
The way I understand this, I don't know if I'm fully right, but makes sense is just like, again, my favorite example of playing a video game. You know, when I play the video game, I know fully well that everything about that video game is not real. It's an illusion. It's false. So I become one of the characters in that video game and I'm playing the game. Let's say it's a driving game. I'm driving the car around superbly. But though I started off with the knowledge that it's all unreal, when we look at car games or even, I don't know, shooting games are there. Any kind of games you see, you have got upgrades available for your car. You can upgrade the car, you can put it, and you collect points to do that. And we see that one of the motivators for people to go on playing the game is to keep upgrading your car, get the fastest car. Actually, if you just step back and ask, what do you mean by fastest car? Your device is in your hand and that's it. I mean, it's all an illusion. And yet, it is our, as you can say, it is the ego that comes in because of the attachment to that. You know, you start thinking that an upgraded car is better than a lower car. This is a better thing to do. And that is how the interaction with that builds up this false image. And in fact, clouds the knowledge that all this is useless. It's of no use. Even a single pie of what I've earned here is of no use to me. But then, in spite of knowing that and saying that, I still say, no, it is very useful. Because, you know, I can buy a best car. I can buy a better car. I can go faster car. How? What do you mean you're buying? No. Yeah, in the game. You know, we need constant reminders to tell that I'm talking about the game. In fact, if I crash my car, I say, oh my God, I'm gone. I died. I crashed. You crashed. You're fine only. Yeah, I mean, in the game. You know, unless we add that additional question, we speak of the game as if we are the game itself. We are in the game. You know, this is that, I think, the illusion that comes through interaction.
Absolutely. I think that's a very, very graphic example, because if you look at it, we are in that stage where we have forgotten that we are playing the game. Right? If you're completely lost that idea that and get involved in whatever accidents are happening in the game or whatever reward that you're winning in the game, I think that's where we are. And that's where Swami is, that pointer of first find out who you are. Then you will know whether, you know, is the world real? Is the problems of the world real? Is what you're pursuing real? And that's really the point to start from, even to start experiencing the world. As Swami was saying that, you know, we have reversed the order. We're experiencing the world and we're putting that inquiry for a later part.
Hmm.
So it's like you start exploring how to use an object before you start using an object. And most of us come to what is the purpose of this life at the very fag end of life, when you know probably you've used up all of it and that knowledge is in fact useless at that point in time.
I may sound a little dramatic, but if we reverse the order, I mean, when you want to play a video game, if I want to take the same order, when Swami says you know first God, you know, get the knowledge and then you go and interact, it's like if you take it in video game parlance, it is very important to know all the while that it's just an illusion and I'm doing it just for fun, that's all. If that is forgotten, you know, all one needs to do is do an internet search. You'll come across stories of addiction that has led to death. Gaming addiction is being recognized as a serious addiction where, you know, I don't know. Again, I think it's an experience that you have to go through. I just can't believe that people forget to go to the restroom. People forget to eat food. People forget to sleep. Give up sleep in the quest of playing the game. And because the body fatigues without food and sleep, it leads to death after 34 hours of continuous gaming. It has happened. Not just this. There has been a case of a social kind of game where a couple are playing the couple game. You know, and in the game, the objective is to build a good home, a good family, take care of your children and do all that. And so engrossed were they in playing the game that the infant actually died of starvation without milk. How dangerous and hazardous it is. They had to be arrested. They were arrested because they are adults. It's equivalent to committing murder of your child, you know. And that dangerous it is when you forget that it's a game, that it's not true. And if that knowledge is clouded by the entertainment factor or by you getting engrossed in the game, it is dangerous. You know, I think the same thing holds good even for the game of life. It is dangerous for us. And that is why, you know, imagine if somebody comes and tells to you that, I don't know why this video game, I've reached this level, I don't know this, but this is not happening, I'm suffering, I can't bear it. You need not even know which video game they're playing. Your answer to them can be, hey, stop all that, find out who you are. Are you that car? Are you that fighter? No, I'll tell you this story now. I don't need the story, I don't need anything. Find out who you are and your problem will get solved. Now, you know, in that light, when you look at it, you understand the wisdom behind the solution for any question, any problem being, but find out who you are, your problem will get solved.
In fact, if the Upanishads were written today, they would have had, you know, the gaming and the video games as example. Because if you really go back to Vedanta, the examples are just like this. They speak about the dream because that's a universal experience. Everybody has this experience that there is nobody in the dream. It's a dream created by you, right? You're one person sleeping and you can create a city in your dream. And then you go through all the emotions just like how you go through in gaming. Similarly, they give examples of pottery because that's again something which is so commonly seen. Right? And that famous dialogue between the father and son, Uddalaka and Shvetaketu. He asks him, have you discovered that by knowing which you know everything? So he says, there can be nothing like that. So he gives the example of clay and pot. He says, if you know the clay, then the pot can be of any shape, you know the pot. Right? So Vedanta it's really the pedagogy which Vedanta follows. It'll always take something which you know already, which you already have experienced, and say, do you realize that this is what you do? The same thing happens in this form. So today, if any of the Upanishads were written, you can be sure that examples will be video games, and it will be movies, it will be, probably all the interactive virtual reality kind of games that we have today.
You know, when you say virtual reality, I feel that is the closest you can come to Maya. Because when we say virtual reality, you go there, you feel the vibrations, you feel the fall. In fact, that has been positively used to help pilots gain valuable flying experience. Because this is a safe place where you can crash without dying, you know. So in that sense, I feel Swami says this world itself is virtual reality. It is virtual. In the virtual reality, we are creating a virtual reality. I mean, I don't know. The deeper we go, more we get lost. Because we are creating a thing that is virtual in the virtual world. But well, as you said, if not anything else, the virtual reality helps to understand and grasp things so easily, because in that sense, we have become God, you know. We have, what God has done with the virtual world, God has done with the world which is supposed to be considered virtual, we have done the similar kind with a virtual world. And we see that though we are the creators of the virtual world, we have become enslaved to the virtual world. And it becomes so easy to extrapolate and understand that this is what Swami is meaning by saying that you are the creator, you are the ultimate, you are the Amrutatva Putra, you are Amrutasya Putra, you are the child of immortality. But you have got sucked into your own creation and become slaves there.
So I think, dear listeners, with that we'll conclude this week's episode. Definitely it's been a heavy episode for both of us. But the variety of questions, as we have always mentioned, is so wide. He has asked questions about devotion. He's asked questions about simple, the future of the world, the future of countries, and of course the most deep concepts of Vedanta. And that's why this satsang has been very useful to all of us, and we hope that you found it as useful as we have found it. Most probably we'll continue this satsang next week also because of the flow which is there. Even now we have stopped it right in the middle of an answer that Swami is giving, because Swami is going to start another theme after the next part. But it is still in continuous flow of the themes that Swami is talking. So we'll continue this satsang on the conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satsaya Baba next week as well. So do join us at 12:30. We'll play a small song for you. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu for the next episode of Love to Love.
Narada di muni gandige sulabhadim dora. listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.